It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's been 2 weeks since an Amtrak passenger train derailed in Philadelphia, killing 8 people and injuring more than 200 others. While the exact cause of the crash still isn't known, there seems to be a consensus on what could have prevented it. U.S. senators, led by Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey, announced they have sent a letter to the Appropriations Committee to increase funding for positive train control, or PTC, which could have prevented the derailment of Amtrak 188. Senator Casey's efforts to obtain funding is the topic of our conversation today. Senator Casey, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, good to be with you. Thank you.
Let's start by having you explain what positive train control is.
Well, it's basically a system that has been advanced over many years. There is a precursor system which gives or creates an opportunity where the train can slow down when it goes over a certain speed, so it can, in a sense, override human error. What positive train control can do, in addition to that basic feature, is take other precautions because of sensors and technology that they have on the track. So if there's an obstruction on the track or there's some other problems with the track, that can also alert the system. And of course, in the case of high speed, if the train is moving too fast, positive train control can override human error and be able to literally slow the train down without the engineer, who's really the person directing the train, without the engineer doing that. So it's remarkable technology, and the good news is we have it. The bad news is it's not implemented on enough of the miles that cross the country, both Amtrak miles as well as other rail miles.
Is there, even though you have explained it very clearly, how it works and how it very well could have prevented what happened 2 weeks ago, are there some who are questioning whether this could have prevented the derailment? And is that what is holding up funding?
I don't think there's a dispute about the technology or the ability of the technology to have a positive impact. But really, this is, I think, part of a larger problem where we haven't invested nearly enough in rail safety, and that means investing in the infrastructure, not just making sure the tracks are safe and that there's upkeep, so to speak, or maintenance, but that when there are technologies available that work and can be deployed and have been deployed, actually, that is made a priority. The complaint or the concern that's been raised by some transit agencies around the country is we want to have positive train control, but we have so many other infrastructure needs that we can't do both. And what the Congress should do, if we're doing the right thing, is to not put Amtrak or any transit agency in the position of having to choose between safety technology like positive train control on the one hand versus fixing crumbling bridges or other parts of the aging infrastructure. So it's a difficult challenge, but I think we get reminders every once in a while of how horrific the circumstances can be when you haven't made the investments. And I say all this with the full knowledge that we don't yet know whether there's a direct connection between the derailment of the Amtrak train in Philadelphia and lack of funding over time. I would make this argument about positive train control even if someone could certify today that there was no connection. That someone might say, well, the train derailed because it was the engineer's error. He was going too fast. He was going 106 miles an hour in a 50-mile-an-hour zone, so it was his fault and has nothing to do with funding. Even if you could prove that, which we can't prove one way or the other yet until the experts tell us. But even if you could prove that, I'd still say we're not investing enough, and positive train control is part of that. Paul, you know the deadline is the end of 2015, and, for example, the transit system in Philadelphia, so-called Southeastern Pennsylvania Transit Authority, SEPTA by the acronym, SEPTA said in the paper last week that they will complete positive train control implementation by the deadline, meaning December 31 of this year, and it cost them several $100 million to do that, and I have no doubt that that meant they had to take that away, those several $100 million away from other infrastructure and maybe even other safety infrastructure investments to get positive train control put into place. So that's just the unfortunate reality is to make this work, it costs money.
Senator Casey, had you or anyone else in Congress, for example, made a push for positive train control before the accident occurred?
Yes. In fact, the first thing that we did, and people in both parties voted for this, was legislation back in 2008, which mandated the positive train control be in place by the end of this year. So that happened in 08, and here we are 7 years later, and we're facing the prospect of some transit agencies not having enough of it in place. On the Northeast Corridor for Amtrak, meaning basically from Boston to Washington or even further, that Northeast Corridor for Amtrak has positive train control in place, but not on every mile. In fact, there are maybe as many as a few hundred miles where it's not in place yet. What the Federal Railroad Administration mandated about a week or two ago, just after the accident, they indicated that if positive train control in the Northeast Corridor was not implemented, they ought to have at least automatic train control, what I'd call, for lack of a better phrase, the older version of positive train control. In other words, that might have helped as well. I don't know if it would have prevented it, but it might have helped in this instance where you have both a curve and a mileage per hour restriction that wasn't being adhered to or complied with. So we've taken some actions, and we have to take more actions to push as hard as we can to make sure it gets implemented as quickly as possible.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and our guest is U.S. Senator Bob Casey. The cost of implementing positive train control is about $2 billion, but Congress to this point has only allocated $50 million is the figure that I have. How will that difference be made up? Where will the money come from?
Well, first of all, we should make determined efforts to get to that number. And it may mean that there won't be no new or additional resources available. We might have to find it within the four corners of the federal budget with existing dollars. But there's no reason why we should be telling Amtrak or transit agencies, you need to have this implemented by the end of December of 2015, but you're only going to get $50 million to do it. And it costs, as you said, $2 billion. That's just not fair. That's probably the best definition of an unfunded mandate that you could think of. So we may have to find the dollars within the existing federal budget, or we may have to get additional revenue. But I would put this under the category of, you know, whatever it takes, whatever has to be done in terms of authority and then the appropriations that follow the authority, we should support.
Funding for Amtrak seems to be under fire on a regular basis. Has the recent derailment added fuel to the fire for Amtrak's critics?
Well, I don't think it's made the argument necessarily any stronger. I hope it would make the argument for funding to be more urgent or the subject of more intensity. Because, like I said, even if this derailment did not occur, I believe before the derailment and after the derailment, the same thing on funding. We need more of it. Even if there's absolutely no connection between the derailment and funding levels, this is just a system that needs upkeep and investment, just like any cost in the life of a family. You know, it's that old expression, you don't just fix a leaky roof after it rains. You try to take preventative steps ahead of time so you prevent the leaky roof. And in this case, the leaky roof may not be always a derailment, but it might be other problems with infrastructure. So it's just one of those debates that we've had for years, and we have to figure out a way to get consensus to move it forward.
We heard today that Amtrak says it will install video cameras inside locomotive cabs that record the actions of train engineers.
Yep.
What do you think of this, and how much might it help?
Well, I'm not an expert in any way, so I can't certify or give an expert opinion on the effect of it, but it just seems to be common sense. The more review you have of what happened, the better off you're going to be to prevent it from happening in the future. Some have suggested having two engineers in the cab instead of just one. That seems pretty common sense as well. Even if there's no allegation of any kind of a problem with the engineer, what if someone has a heart attack and they're the only engineer in the cab? It's just like the old rule that I was taught a long time ago, never get in a plane without two engines and two pilots. And that's probably the same rule that should apply for a locomotive that's carrying behind it the passenger trains, or as we're increasingly seeing now, these derailments with crude oil, which have expanded exponentially across the country, and we're getting hundreds more trains through Pennsylvania every day with crude oil from kind of the northwestern part of the United States through our state, and that's just of, I think, has to be of great concern as well.
Vice President Biden famously used Amtrak on a daily basis, and I believe you do as well.
Yes.
So go ahead.
I'm on Amtrak most Mondays of the year getting to Washington between Philadelphia and Washington. I live in Scranton, so I usually get a ride from Scranton to Philly, and that's halfway, and the other half of the trip is Philly to D.C., and then I'm usually on it a lot of Thursday nights or Fridays or... So I'm on Amtrak a lot of weeks, at least two different trips, and it's a great way to travel, never have any concern about it. I took a train this Saturday morning. We finished voting in the Senate about 1:30 or so in the morning, and I was meeting my wife for an anniversary trip to New York, so I took an 8 a.m. train to New York. It was a great way to get to New York to meet my wife. I wouldn't have been able to meet her any other way, so it's a great system for passengers, and it helps people get to destinations. It helps people transact business, but we have to make sure that it's as safe as possible, and I never gave the safety of the train much thought until the derailment, so it does make you probably more aware of some of the challenges of the upkeep that is needed in the system. You know, for example, Paul, you go through some of these tunnels, for example. The tunnel in Baltimore is about 100 years old or more, for example. You go through a train in Baltimore that takes, 15 minutes, a pretty long tunnel with a train moving pretty fast. And that tunnel is 100 years old, and that's pretty common. So it's an old system, and it needs a lot of repair, and it just makes sense that we've got to make those investments.
Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey joining us by phone to talk about developments in the wake of the tragic derailment of Amtrak 188. Just over 2 weeks ago today. Senator Casey, thanks for taking the time to join us and discuss these issues. We appreciate it.
Paul, thanks so much.
Coming up, how a field where George Washington walked in Harmony, Pennsylvania, is being threatened by a developer and what the Harmony Museum is doing about it. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. An historic field George Washington walked on in Harmony, Pennsylvania, is being threatened by a developer who wants to flatten a nearby hill and deposit the fill onto the historic land. Fighting to preserve the floodplain and the historic significance of the area is Historic Harmony, the nonprofit that operates the Harmony Museum. I'm joined now in studio by John Roush, president of Historic Harmony. John Roush, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This story goes back to 1753, and you really don't need to be much of a history buff to know that this is some two decades before the revolution kicked in. So let me begin with a question about what brought George Washington to Western Pennsylvania in the first place.
He was a young man and wanted to start a military career. He volunteered to the lieutenant governor of Virginia to go tell the French to get out of British territory. And so he trekked up here with a big party and some Indian native chiefs to go with him, met with the French, delivered the message. They said, why don't the Brits stay out of New France? And so we had the French and Indian War.
And he stopped
at an Indian village that was approximately at the location of Harmony today.
And he ended up nearly losing his life.
Yeah, on his way back, an Indian that was allied with the French tried leading George and his guide the shortest route to the point and took him to the northeast, which is kind of the wrong direction. And then turned around and took a shot at Washington and missed.
Literally fired at him and missed. And
yeah,
that's how close the father of our nation nearly didn't become the father of our nation.
Well, the whole history of the United States may have changed had the guy been more accurate.
So, very historic event. It takes place in western Pennsylvania, again in this field in Harmony. We went up there a couple of years ago and did a piece here on the program about it. So now we'll fast forward 260 years to the present, and you can go to Harmony today and you can literally retrace Washington's footsteps. This is historic land, but now it's being threatened. Who is doing this and why?
Well, the land has been farmland since 1805, and the last farmer who owned it died, I don't know, close to 20 years ago now, and the executor of the estate sold it. It was a private sale. None of us even knew it was on the market, or we would have bought it then. And then it changed hands from one developer to another, to the guy who owns it now. He has, over the years, come up with a series of plans for a residential development called Creekside Manor. It's 47 acres. It's basically in the floodplain, with the exception of the hill that surrounds it on two sides. And, of course, the creek is on the south side of it. And there are existing houses and one of our historic properties on the east. And each time he's come up with a different plan, it's been bigger. And so he's talking about high density. He was talking about 500 residential units packed in there. And we just think the floodplain is perhaps the dumbest place in the whole county of Butler to build a residential development. Its highest and best use is either as continued farmland, green space, as a park or something. There's a better use for that than trying to put residential housing in there.
So this
it
is
also happens to be a very historic property.
Right. So there's the history, but it's also an environmental issue.
Yeah.
And so you've got the floodplain, and so there's the importance of preserving that as well.
In 2004, in the Hurricane Ivan flood, there was 7 to 8 feet of water in the lower part of Harmony, directly across the creek from this site. And that site was almost entirely underwater, except where he's already put some fill in. You know, if you take a bucket of water and you fill the bucket of water and then put a brick into it, the water's going to go somewhere else, all over your shoes. It just makes sense that if you eliminate 20 to 30 acres from the floodplain, there's 20 to 30 acres of water that's got to go somewhere else in the next flood. And that was a 100-year flood. I think most of the hydrology studies that are done for this kind of stuff look at what kind of drainage comes off that property. In the case of a 100-year flood, ain't no drainage. It's all coming from the Conequenessing Creek and filling it up like the bucket.
So what is your organization, Historic Harmony, doing to preserve this land, not only for the reasons, the environmental concerns that you have, but also from the aspect of preserving a piece of U.S. history?
Well, we have a multiple mission. We're a 501c3 nonprofit founded in 1943, and our mission is not only to operate the Harmony Museum for the education of the public, but also to encourage economic development and tourism in the county and the area in cooperation with other organizations. And we don't see anything positive in that regard if this site was developed into anything. Now, he has previously had these different proposals for housing, one of which was actually approved, but he just never built it. Now he's developing a property, a commercial property next door that fronts on Route 19, the Prairie Highway, for a commercial, a company that wants to move from Cranberry Township up into Jackson Township. We have no quarrel with that, think it's a good project, would be very valuable to the area. He has no housing plan before anybody for approval at this point, but he wants to take that hillside property and level it for the commercial building that has to go onto it and put it into the floodplain. We think it ought to be the other way around. You don't do something with, you don't get a permit to do anything like filling in a floodplain when you don't have any plan before the public on what you're actually going to do with it.
We're talking with John Roosh. He is president of Historic Harmony, a group that is trying to preserve the floodplain and the historical significance of a field in Harmony where George Washington walked in 1753. It's being threatened by a developer who wants to flatten a nearby hill and deposit the fill onto that historic land. Let's take the environmental aspect out of this and just look at the history. Why does it matter? I mean, yes, George Washington was there, but it was years ago. The land has changed somewhat. What does it matter whether that land is preserved or not?
Well, it's a lot more than just George Washington, actually. There were the Indians before George Washington. We know it was common to recover artifacts on that site every time somebody plowed the field. 50 years after Washington, when Harmony was founded by German immigrants who were seeking religious freedom, that was the first property, first land that they cleared for agricultural use in 1805. And they then developed on that site. They had a labyrinth, which was a religious, had religious connotations. They could go there and walk the labyrinth and meditate. Their doctor also had an herb garden over there, and they had a number of buildings over there, and, including an, they had several barns. We own the only one that survives, and they grazed sheep on it, and they farmed it. So it's we've got the Indian aspect of it, and it's never been explored from an archaeology standpoint. And the state's regulation of that when it comes to private property is atrocious and needs to be changed because there's basically none, no protection. So there's a lot we haven't even learned on that. This just is a site. It's very attractive, less attractive since the developer cut down a bunch of trees a year ago on it. Reasons not really clear. And from a community standpoint, it's worth saving from the historical aspect as well as the environmental threat that it poses if it's filled.
So where do things stand? It comes down to a matter of preservation versus development. Where do things stand?
Most recently, he had applied for a permit that would fill in the whole site, and he had delineated wetlands that are on the site. The DEP... We enlisted the support of Penn Future, and they provided legal assistance at the beginning. They did a full review. DP came down, did a walkthrough, and discovered that the developer's plan for the fill going into the site inaccurately depicted the wetlands. And instead of being, I don't know, less than an acre, it turned out to be like 2.5 or 3 acres of wetlands. So the DEP said you can't do anything on the wetlands, and since they're that size, the Corps of Engineers gets involved as well. And so he threw in the towel and said, okay, I won't put anything in the floodway, and I won't put anything on the wetlands. And initially we thought that meant that he wasn't going to fill the site at all, and then he immediately started talking about filling the rest of it, avoiding the wetlands. So it's still we don't have a resolution.
John Roosh is president of Historic Harmony in the town where George Washington walked and was nearly killed 260 years ago. thank you so much for joining us, for shedding light on this issue, and we'll look forward to talking to you in the not-too-distant future to find out how this does, in fact, resolve itself.
Thanks, Paul. We'll keep you posted.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate it. Coming up, former Steelers All-Pro linebacker Andy Russell talks about the Gridiron Gold event honoring Western Pennsylvania's Pro Football Hall of Fame quarterbacks. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. On Saturday, June 6th, the six native Western Pennsylvanians who are Pro Football Hall of Fame quarterbacks, Joe Namath, Jim Kelly, Joe Montana, and Dan Marino, along with the late Johnny Unitas and George Blanda, will be honored at a benefit event called Gridiron Gold. Joining us now to discuss the details of the event is one of the organizers, All-Pro linebacker Andy Russell, who played his entire 12-year career with the Pittsburgh Steelers. He was an early member of Pittsburgh's famed Steel Curtain defense, made seven Pro Bowl appearances, and earned two Super Bowl rings. Andy Russell, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, thanks for having me.
If you have a comment or question for Andy Russell, you can call 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at ESSPGH. This is a unique concept. Andy, do you know who came up with the idea for this?
Yes, it was an idea that Diane Balcom had, and she represents the Legal Services Association as one of their fundraisers for that group.
And the Legal Services Association is the beneficiary of this.
It is, and Art Rooney II and the Neighborhood Legal Services are the two that made this happen, you know, really. Although Diane Balcom has sold all the tables, so I think it's pretty amazing.
And explain what this particular service is, what they do.
Well, I think half the money that's going to be raised is going to be go to the quarterbacks and to their family charitable foundations or to some important thing that they want to give the money to. The other half goes to the Neighborhood Legal Services Association, which helps people in a lot of legal situations.
Isn't it a little odd for a linebacker to be honoring quarterbacks?
Yes, it is, because we hate quarterbacks. But, you know, I have a lot of respect for these six. I mean, they're all in the Hall of Fame. They were terrific players, and not all of them won Super Bowls, but some of them did, and it's very impressive. I think this is going to be a great event, and we've almost sold out all the tables. They're $5,000 each, 10 seats, or people could buy a seat for $500. And there's still some room left. If any of the listeners want to find out if they can get a seat, they could call Diane Balcom at 412-586-6140.
And we can put a link to that information on our website at WESA.FM. Again, our number, if you have a comment or question for former Steeler Andy Russell, 412-246-2002, the number to call, 412-246-2002. You talked about having admiration for these quarterbacks. It was a different game when you played. In many ways, it could be considered a more violent game. There weren't the rules to protect the quarterbacks that exist today, such as in the grass, for example, where a quarterback might not have been brought down to the ground, but the whistle will blow to stop the play to prevent, you know, any further harm to that particular quarterback. But you had more of a free rein and a free shot at those guys years ago.
Oh, much dramatically different game today. We could hit the quarterbacks below the waist, you know, going to their knees, because you might be falling. You might have been tripped as you got into on the blitz, and so you're going down, and you have to do that. Now they won't allow you to do that. We could go to the head. We could hit them in the back of the head or in the front of the face or whatever. So it's just a, you know, I'm somewhat concerned they're going to sissify the game. You know, that's a potential problem. But I know the NFL is working hard to try to solve the concussion problem that exists, and that probably is going to go with better equipment. You know, all the kinds of things that can help that.
Well, and Joe Namath has said recently that if he knew what he knows now about concussions, and I'm paraphrasing him, I'm not giving an exact quote here, but essentially what he said was, I would not have played football if I had known what I know now. So clearly there are concerns years later. We're hearing a lot about concussion issues and about symptoms players are suffering as a result of playing professional football. What, if anything, worries you when you hear about what Tony Dorsett and Jim McMahon, for example, and others are going through?
Well, I personally can remember that I had 10 concussions. And I probably...
10 concussions.
10 concussions that I can remember. There's probably another 10 that I can't remember. And my family charitable foundation gives money to the UPMC Concussion Center, which is the largest concussion center in the country, serving 25,000 people last year. And I went in and took all the tests, and I thought I did horribly. But they said, well, Andy, we can't really say that it has anything to do with your football experience. It could be because it happens to lots of people. They get Alzheimer's or whatever happens.
What do you think?
And I think that, I'm trying to keep my brain as active as I can. I do read a lot of books. I read, I like to send emails and type and write books. So
you've written two, in fact.
Yeah, well, I've written three.
Three, sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
And I enjoy that. It's a challenge to do it. But I think we've got to keep using our brains. And all people, older people, have this problem. They start forgetting things, whether they played football or not.
So do you get the sense that some of, you know, what you might be feeling, or what, you know, you said you were dissatisfied with your test results. Do you feel that anything might be football related, or do you simply not know at this point?
Well, at this point, I'm being told by the EPMC Concussion Center that they can't really tie any issues I have. You know, they'll give you a test where they give you 14 words, and then you have to give it back to them, you know, but you can't write it down. So it's kind of hard to remember 14 words in a row. I thought I did miserably on that. Maybe I got 8 of them correct or whatever. But the older folks who've never played football, who are having some memory problems, it's very normal. It's not unusual. People have to keep using their brain, paying attention to details, and it's so they're not, they haven't really, I know the NFL is trying very hard to eliminate as many concussions, and we'll see how that turns out.
When you look back on your career, do you have any regrets? Is there anything that you say, anything about your career? You played for a dozen years, and you mentioned the 10 concussions that you know of. Do you look back on anything and say, gosh, I wish maybe I had limited my career to 7 or 8 years instead of 12, or wish that maybe I had, if I wasn't feeling particularly well, if my head wasn't clear, that I had not gone back into a game or sat out a game, that kind of thing?
No, you know, I really, I grew up in playing with guys who played in the 50s, like guys like Ernie Stotner, and these were some of the toughest guys I've ever met.
Former Steeler Hall of Famer Ernie Stotner.
Yeah, Stotner came in the huddle one time, and he had broken his thumb, and the bone was sticking out of his hand. And I hadn't seen too many bones in the huddle. And he's not going to leave the game for one play.
Where's the trainer during all this?
He's just not even showing it to the trainer because he's on the field. He's not going to leave, you know, and he closes his hand over the thumb, and he says, "What's the defense?" You know, I'm like, "Oh my God, he's not even going to leave play for one game." And so that was what they taught: never show your opponent you're hurt. Always never lay on the ground. Always get back to the huddle. Get up, get back to the huddle. Whatever you do. I remember one time I was playing in Green Bay, and I hit their fullback pretty hard, and his knee. This is a guy that could squat 750 about 20, 30 times, and his knee hit my head, and I saw the bright flash of light that you know you had a concussion. But I know I can't lay there on the ground. I can't. I have to get up and get back to the huddle. So I get back up and I stagger back into the huddle. And Bart Starr says, "No, Andy, you're in the wrong huddle." That, oh, I was in the Green Bay
Packers.
Packers huddle.
Wow. Wow. That's, well, that tells you something. Was it a source of pride for players back then to, you know, to be the toughest guy and not show that you were hurt?
It was our mantra that you never show you're hurt. You're hurt. You play hurt. You know. And I would go back in with torn knee ligaments and things like that. I just was going to play as long as the Steelers would allow me to play. And sometimes the coaches might take me out. But I only came out one time when I got hurt in the first Super Bowl, late in the third quarter, and I knew that my backup could play better with a good strong knee than I could play limping around in the field. So I thought I got to get out of here. So
this was Super Bowl IX, the one in New Orleans,
number 9. Yeah,
yeah. And do you think that players are different today? Is there a different mentality?
I think there's absolutely a different mentality. One, because they have agents who tell them you can't play hurt. You got to come out of the game and just make sure you rehab it and take your time doing it because you want to have a long career and so forth and so on. That's totally the opposite of what we were told by the older players. And
does that make sense to a guy like you from the era in which you played? You said sissified earlier. Does that fall under that heading?
Well, yeah, I can remember criticizing Terry Bradshaw because he'd get hit and then he'd lay on the ground and he'd be carried off the field. And then 3 or 4 plays later, he'd go back in. I mean, come on. He got carried off the field and now you're going back in the game and throwing a winning touchdown and all the fans are saying, wow, what a tough guy. No. I mean, so I gave Terry a hard time about that. He didn't like it, but you know, I said, "Come on, you don't lay on the ground and get carried off the field and come back 2 plays later." I mean, that's unacceptable.
We're talking with former Steeler Andy Russell, and he is one of the organizers of an event taking place on June 6th. That's called the Gridiron Gold, in which the 6 native Western Pennsylvanians who are Pro Football Hall of Fame quarterbacks Joe Namath, Jim Kelly, Joe Montana, and Dan Marino, along with the late Johnny Unitas and George Blanda, will be honored. It's a benefit event. Again, Gridiron Gold is what it's called. And you played against Joe Namath, Johnny Unitas, and I believe as well George Blanda. Describe what it was like going up against those particular extraordinary quarterbacks.
Well, they were absolutely terrific quarterbacks, and but they also had some superb receivers, so that guys were getting open and they could deliver the ball, so they were very impressive, and I had great respect for them. I mentioned that both George Blanda and Johnny Unitas have passed away, but Mrs. Blanda, George's wife, will be there at this event, and so will John Unitas Jr., his son. So they're all going to be there to be honored, and I think it's just going to be a phenomenal event. And it's going to be at the Wyndham Grand Hotel. As you said, June 6th starts at 5 p.m. Reception and dinner, and black tie is optional. And there'll be a roundtable discussion. They're not going to give speeches, but a roundtable discussion with the quarterbacks led by NFL Films.
That will be interesting. You know, to the naked eye, when we you know, you look at the quarterback, he stands back there. I mean, they're all generally bigger guys, you know, unless you're talking about Fran Tarkenton, and they have certain athletic, you know, comparable athletic abilities. But obviously there are things that you would know as a player that you would see that differentiate, that made these particular quarterbacks great, and particularly with the ones that you got up and close and personal with and played against. Unitas, Blanda, Joe Namath. What made them great? What were the things that stood out for you as a player that separated them from the rest, that made them these great Hall of Fame quarterbacks?
Well, I think, number one, they were smart. They knew what they were doing. They paid attention to details, which you have to do. Number two, they had strong arms and could throw the ball very well. Most of them could hit a tire hanging from a goalpost 60 yards away, that type of thing.
Wow.
Tremendous talent, physical talent. And and they played with a lot of heart. So they were just very impressive guys.
On another one of these off the field issues that that people have been talking about, last week more than 200 players filed a lawsuit claiming that all 32 NFL teams, their doctors, trainers, medical staffs, obtained and provided painkillers to players, often illegally, as part of a conspiracy to keep them on the field without regard for their long-term health. What were the things that went on when you were playing? Did you see any of this? What about this rings true for you?
Well, that is true, but I don't think the owners knew that about that. As I said, the old NFL, these guys were so tough. I mean, they just, they played hurt. And, of course, they were asking the trainers for pills for pain. And the trainers would give them a nice pill, and maybe it's an aspirin or whatever. But, I remember taking lots of pills for pain that I had. And
Did you know what they were?
I don't really remember what they were. I mean,
did you want to know at the time, or did it not matter?
I didn't care as long as it helped, and it did help a little bit. But the bandages, people sometimes say to me, what hurts on your body now? Here I am, 40, 50 years out of the game, and it's my hands. Because I broke every finger at least once, some twice, and I broke both thumbs twice. So, my hands will ache sometimes doing something simple like tying my shoes, but that's not such a serious thing to complain about.
Well, Preston Pearson, the former Steeler running back, he has suffered in older age with some of the residual effects of playing pro football. But he said he wouldn't trade the Super Bowl rings that he won, that whatever he's going through now, however he has suffered, that it was all worth it. You've won a couple of Super Bowl rings. What are your feelings? How do you feel about?
I feel exactly the same way. I mean, I would not give up any part of my career. I was very fortunate not to be badly injured. When you break your leg or something when you can't possibly go back in, but I wouldn't trade anything. And make changes. I mean, it was to me a great NFL the career that a player has if he's lucky enough to stay healthy, and I feel very blessed in that regard.
I noticed that you do not wear the rings. You have your wedding ring on, but you don't wear the Super Bowl rings.
Well, actually, the reason I don't is I gave one of them to my wife, who made it into a bracelet.
Oh.
And the other one I sold because I was wanting to raise money for my grandchildren's educations, which, as you know, today's college fees are extraordinarily expensive. The reason I did that is I thought I could get a new one from the jeweler that would be exactly the same, except it wouldn't have been the original one, but it would be exactly the same.
Would you have to pay for that?
I'd pay for it, but a lot less than what I could sell it for.
See? Right, right.
And so I thought this is a no-brainer. I've got to do that. Well, as I discovered, the NFL has a rule that you can only get a new ring if you lost it or it was stolen. If you sold it, you can't get one. So I can't.
They won't let you buy. They won't let Andy Russell buy another Super Bowl.
No, they won't let me do it. So, I'm discouraged about that. That's where I'm not wearing. And I'm trying to get the other. My wife is now trying to make that bracelet back into a real ring, which was the one we for getting the Cowboys number 10.
Right.
I'd love to wear that some more. But my kids are upset because they didn't want me to do that.
Well, what about for you? Because this would not be an issue for today's players. They make enough money that funding their child's college education would not be a struggle. But for someone like you who played in an era when you didn't make as much money, that's a fact of life. Does that create any kind of sense of resentment for you that you weren't paid as generously as guys you see out there today?
No, I don't resent that at all. I think that, you know, for example, once a Steeler last year made more money in one game. He was getting paid $9,750,000, and you divide that by 16 games, it comes out like $575,000, you know, a game. Well, that was more money than I made in 12 years in the NFL. Because I added it all together. I started out $12,000 my rookie year. I made the All-Pro rookie team. They gave me $14,000. I made the Pro Bowl. I got $18,000. You know, that, so it just it didn't add up to over to what this guy made per game. Well, but that's okay. I mean, that's the success of the NFL. The NFL's been tremendously successful, and a lot of because it has to do with television, and it's all over the world. People are watching it. I've watched. Super Bowls in Switzerland. It's an amazing world.
You know, we were talking before the show about how when you were in college, your father was working in Brussels, Belgium. And so he encouraged you to come over to Europe and take a bike trip. Or he thought this would be a character building thing. And I think your football team at Missouri encouraged this. So you had a chance to have this experience biking across Europe. That's where your family lived. You lived in a lot of different parts of the United States growing up, and then you played your football here, and now you've settled in Pittsburgh. What led you to stay in Pittsburgh or to want to be here?
Well, growing up, I was what my father referred to as a corporate brat. So I was born in Detroit, lived there 8 years, Chicago 2.5 years, New York 4 years, you know, then St. Louis, Missouri, and then my parents moved to Brussels, Belgium, and Geneva, Switzerland when I was in college. But my favorite town is Pittsburgh. I just love it. I think it's of all those places I've lived, it's the nicest city. I think it's underrated around the country. People they think of it as, you know, smokestacks and steel mills
still?
And things like that.
Still?
Well, some people do. I mean, but we know that's not true. And Pittsburgh is a beautiful city, and the river, three rivers, and it's great.
We have about a minute left. Before we let you go, I wanted to ask you, because everybody's still talking about Deflategate. What are your thoughts about that? What's your take on it?
Well, you know, frankly, I don't really understand why a quarterback would want to deflate the ball. I would think that would be more difficult to throw than it would be a tight, you know, solid ball. So I don't really understand what they're talking about. And you know, it just doesn't make any sense. Now, I can remember what Ray Mansfield, the Steelers center, was hiking a ball for a field goal, and the Raiders had deflated that ball. Now, I can understand that because a deflated ball would be harder to kick, but not necessarily why anybody would say it's easier to throw or easier to catch.
What's the appropriate punishment for somebody who cheats?
Well, the NFL, you know, building some serious rules about what they're, and they, you know, will fine players. They will, expel them for 3 or 4 games, depending on, you know, like even one of our running backs is going to have that problem. But so, you know, that seems fair enough to me, you know.
Four games?
Not much more than that.
Fair enough. And Tom Brady will probably be in the Hall of Fame someday. In the meantime, the 6 Western Pennsylvania quarterbacks who are in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, again, being honored on June 6th, Joe Namath, Jim Kelly, Joe Montana, Dan Marino, Johnny Unitas, and George Blanda. One of the organizers for the event has been our guest, former Steeler, All-Pro linebacker, Andy Russell. Andy, it's been such a pleasure visiting with you. We're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, thank you for having me. It was fun.
And that will do it for today's Essential Pittsburgh. If you missed any portion of the program or want to revisit past segments, go to our website at wesa.fm. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.